Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're learning more about Faisal Shahzad, the suspect in Saturday's attempted Times Square car bombing, including his ties to Pakistan. We'll have more from the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Islamabad in just a few moments. But first, questions are still being asked about how Shahzad was able to get on that plane at JFK Airport on Monday night and nearly get away. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that law enforcement officers were staking him out on Monday when media trucks pulled into his neighborhood. Did they tip him off? He did slip away. How did that happen? Why didn't his purchase of a plane ticket in cash later Monday trigger an alert? And what about the no-fly list? It wasn't until late Monday night when customs officials were scrutinizing passenger lists that anyone discovered that Shahzad had just boarded a midnight flight to Dubai. New York Times reporter Scott Shane has been looking at all of this. He joins us. And Scott, let's take these one at a time. Shahzad booked that one-way flight to Dubai from his car at 6:30 Monday night on his way to the airport, but he was put on the no-fly list at 12:30. So why didn't that stop the reservation from going through at 6:30?
Well, apparently the no-fly list was indeed updated. Of course, what the government says, it was updated at 12:30, and that a few minutes later they sent a kind of emergency electronic notice to all the airlines saying, because they didn't have any idea that he was about to get on an Emirates flight, they alerted all the airlines to check the no-fly list because an important name has been added. Allegedly, Emirates did not do that, so they did not have his name. They had an outdated copy of the no-fly list they were checking, and when he gave his name, his own name, to buy this ticket, it didn't trigger anything.
It wasn't on the list that they had. And, well, the Washington Post, we should say, is also reporting that Emirates officials said they flagged the cash purchase but got no response from the government. Officials in the government say they don't have a record of that. But so let's say, let's stop there. Let's say, okay, Emirates Airlines had an old copy of the no-fly list without his name. Isn't a cash purchase supposed to, you know, post 9/11, when the 9/11 attackers, it was learned, paid in cash, we thought a cash purchase was supposed to immediately set off alarms?
There seems to be some confusion about what's required. Yesterday I was told by the Department of Homeland Security initially that the airlines were required to report it in a timely manner, the fact that someone bought a ticket with cash, and that in this case Emirates did report it, but they didn't report it for hours. And by the time they reported it, Shahzad was already in custody. They subsequently called back and corrected that and said there isn't a requirement. And in fact, there's a call on Capitol Hill today to change the rules to sort of step up the requirements for scrutiny for people buying with cash. Of course, buying with cash in some countries is very much standard practice. Buying with cash in other places is not, you know, certainly JFK it would be much more unusual.
Right. Well, and we're also hearing about other changes today from the Homeland Security, apparently telling the Associated Press that effective immediately, all airlines will have to check the no-fly list within 2 hours of updates instead of 24 hours. So the requirement prior to this past weekend was, oh, you only have to check the updates every 24 hours?
Well, normally you're not in a kind of emergency situation like this. You know, in fact, there's a kind of a nomination and review process. Someone is nominated, that's the term they use, for this list, and then there's a review process, and they decide whether to put the person on or not. And, of course, we have to remember that in the past there have been many complaints about people with no ties to terrorism turning up on these lists mm-hmm. and being hassled at airports.
I guess it's just new for all of us because there's an assumption on the part of many that it's an automatic thing, that your name, just as soon as it gets taken in, goes into some computer. It's not a matter of the airlines having to update it. It's automatic.
Well, and in fact, the government has been planning for a while to change the system in a way that would have affected this case, and that is to take the checks out of the hands of the airlines and to assign the Transportation Security Administration the authority to actually go ahead and make the checks themselves.
Well, Scott, just to, in the minute we have, there's been a lot of praise for law enforcement for what sounds like a hair-raising 50 or so hours. But then they lost Shahzad for several hours when he slipped out of his home. So I know there are questions about that, but have you heard any more about these reports that media trucks, satellite trucks, rolled into his neighborhood? That had to, if that's true, that had to be a leak from law enforcement to the media.
I haven't gone back to analyze the timing of all that, but I did hear from FBI folks yesterday that they thought that the first reports of a Pakistani-American or someone with Pakistan ties getting being associated with the attempted bombing were out, and that it was possible that he panicked as a result of the media reports. Of course, he would have had every reason to flee apart from the media reports, so it's hard to know exactly.
Yeah. New York Times reporter Scott Shane covering the attempted Times Square car bombing from Washington. Scott, thanks as always.
Thanks very much.
Well, let's turn now to Pakistan. Faisal Shahzad reportedly received 4 calls on his cell phone from Pakistan just hours before he bought that SUV that he then packed with explosives. We remember he was born in Pakistan, came to the U.S. at the age of 18 for a college education, became a naturalized citizen a little over a year ago. He also reportedly admitted to officials that he received bomb-making training in the Taliban stronghold of Waziristan. So, is this potentially the first Pakistani Taliban attack on the U.S.? The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones is in Islamabad in Pakistan. He's long reported from that region. Let's get response to the failed attack from there, from Owen. And thanks, first of all, for joining us.
Not at all. Pleasure.
And is there an answer to that question? Do we know if this was officially a Taliban attack?
Not yet. I mean, they've claimed it, and the government here is saying it's too soon to say, which I suppose is fair enough. But if this Waziristan connection is established, then I think it would be a fair claim to say that this would be a Taliban operation. There are 2 Waziristans. These are tribal areas right on the border with Afghanistan, and it is the hardest hardline area. And there's a South Waziristan, North Waziristan. The army's in the south and have been for months fighting hard. And the north they haven't dealt with yet. It's one of the last 2 remaining areas that haven't been cleared of Taliban. So it's still very, very out of control. And if there's a connection there, that would be significant.
Well, and so the thinking is that a 30-year-old who's foundering around in Connecticut can't afford to pay his mortgage. It's unlikely that he's going to make his way to some sort of Taliban training camp by himself. And we know that there were others arrested in Pakistan. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, no, not really, because the Interior Minister here is saying that no one else has been arrested. The local media are reporting that lots of people have been arrested. We did go and try and find the father. I mean, the thing about the father is that he it's an incredible thing. But I mean, he was a deputy chief of the Air Force here. Now, this was some time ago. And I did mention this point to a senior official here in Pakistan, and they just went, well, there you go, that's the Zia era for you, meaning that, you know, a man of that age would have been appointed by General Zia, who tended to appoint very religiously minded people way back, and therefore, you know, how can they be blamed for that today, sort of thing. So nonetheless, it is obviously embarrassing for Pakistan that this is yet another incident with a Pakistan connection.
Well, and we are mindful of others. Recently, 5 Washington, D.C. area men were captured in Pakistan, were under investigation for meeting up with a terror group there. We have others with U.S. citizenship, like Shahzad, who have been accused in the past 2 years of supporting or attempting to carry out attacks on U.S. soil. What are people saying there about that connection?
They say that the radicalization takes place in the U.K., in the West, in the U.S., and they come to Pakistan for training. So there is a sense in which when Pakistan gets the blame, people say, well, actually, you know, there is a bit of a shared blame on this because these young men are so angry and they're so willing to do this. All that comes from your countries. And then, OK, they come here and they get training and it's unsatisfactory and the security system should be better and so on. But, you know, there is a point in that.
Well, there is that point. And then on the other hand, the rebuttal might be that actually they're recruited online, that these are websites and this is recruitment that happens online from within Pakistan.
The fact is that these young men in the UK and I'm sure in the US are upset and they have a grievance. And in the UK in particular, you know, their economic indicators, their health indicators, their housing indicators, every single indicator you look at are much worse than the rest of the population. I'm talking about Pakistani communities.
Right.
And that is the cause.
But then we have, here's a young man who was involved in Wall Street in some way, and he came from a very wealthy family, so in Pakistan. So is there a sense of increased screening of 30-year-old young men from the U.S. who travel to Pakistan and on to Waziristan?
Yeah, there is a lot of work that goes in on profiling and trying to work out the kind of people who might be involved. And I suspect this young man may well sort of break the profiles, if you see what I mean. So it wouldn't have really worked.
Well, and just one last question before we move on to a broader look at the Taliban in Pakistan. All sorts of questions today about the fact that he left his car keys in the car, including his house key. So investigators, you know, had the key to his home. He gave a fake name, but his cell phone number to the college girl who sold him this car. He's being said to be not all that bright about doing this, and that's sort of translating to the Taliban. But on the other hand, perhaps he had his keys and left all these clues because he had intended to be a suicide car bomb. Would that fit a Taliban profile, a suicide car bomb, or is that...
Well, there are lots of them here in Pakistan. I mean, they happen every week. But to my mind, the much more common theme of the attacks in the UK and the US is their incompetence. You know, I mean, it happens time and time again that these people attempt to put bombs in the middle of London, in Glasgow, wherever, and they never go off.
Well, thank goodness. Give us a primer. The Pakistani Taliban, how are they different from the Afghan Taliban, beside the obvious difference? And we always hear that in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, there's a good Taliban that can be brought back into the mainstream and a bad Taliban that can't. So give us the primer.
Okay, well, this is how it works. There's an Afghan Taliban, which is basically fighting a nationalist resistance against U.S. occupation forces. And the description of good and bad Taliban rests to the degree to which, you know, you think these people will be prepared to negotiate with the U.S., or not. But in fact, all the negotiations come down to will you withdraw or not, and when the US says no, the negotiations are over. In Pakistan, there is a rather different setup where there are probably, I mean, I once counted it up, and I reckon 27 different strands and groups, and you could probably go more than that. So, you know, there are lots of different elements to it, all with their different leaderships, different funding arrangements, and all the rest of it. And together, they form the Taliban in Pakistan. And they are quite distinct from the Taliban in Afghanistan. They share some goals, but there are some things they differ on. So that is the basic primer.
Right. And I hate to be so America-centric, but is there one strand of the Taliban that may be more likely to appeal to disaffected young men in the U.S.?
Well, all of them are anti-American. So, no, I don't think you could sort of separate out one. Mm.
Tell us more about the leader of the TTP. That's the main Taliban group. This is Haqmullah Massoud, thought to have been killed in a drone attack, but recently showed up on a video very much alive. What was the reaction to that?
Well, there is uncertainty here. It's extremely difficult to get news out of Waziristan because, frankly, you know, it is utterly ludicrously reckless to go there. There are sort of rumours flying around as to how well he was on that video and, what sort of shape he's in and so on. These drone attacks are often a bit like that, that obviously they're done remotely, so it's extremely difficult to work out what's happened on the ground. I mean, I do understand that sometimes they try and fly in teams within the first few minutes of an attack to take DNA samples so they can actually work out who they've killed. I mean, I've never had that confirmed, but I have heard that is the case. And you can see the difficulties that the attacking forces have in actually working out whether they've hit their target.
That's the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Pakistan, where he's been asking the question, why is the Taliban so popular? When we come back, we'll have his answer. Also later today, John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter on the future of the American Church, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Islamabad, Pakistan, in light of the fact that the Pakistani-American arrested in the Times Square failed car bombing has reportedly said he had training in Pakistan. And Owen, you were telling us about the appeal the Taliban might have to disaffected young men in the West, like Mr. Shahzad. But what's the appeal of the Taliban for Pakistanis in Pakistan?
Oh, well, I've just been working on it, actually. I've just been out here for a couple of weeks doing film and some radio stuff on that issue. And so, basically, there is the anti-Americanism. There's also state failure here in Pakistan, where the state is so monumentally incompetent that people are just sick of it and they can't get their children educated and they can't get... I mean, there are people literally every day committing suicide because they can't feed their families. I mean, I wanted to cover one of these stories and ask some local reporters if they could find some for me, and I got about 15 in 24 hours. 15 cases, not all happened in one day, but, you know, of people who had committed suicide because they can't cope, because they don't have enough money to feed their very large families. Yeah, it's desperate. And I mean, this has been going on for some time, I have to say, but it is a sign of why people think, well, you know, I mean, it can't get much worse. And if the Taliban come along and say, you know, I can make it better for you, that they'll give it a go. But I mean, there is, so I mean, that takes me on to, you know, the thing I've been trying to work on, which is there is a class element to this. It is, in a sense, a class struggle. It's a revolutionary movement as well as a militant movement, a religious movement, and whatever, fighting an established, corrupt, decadent order that governs Pakistan, misgoverns Pakistan.
Of course, we followed the ebbs and flows here, the military government, the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. But is that, because I was going to say, what's the major disconnect? Is it that people aren't getting services? Is it that money's not flowing to towns and communities? But you've just said it. It's a class struggle.
Well, I mean, that is one element of it, without a doubt. I mean, because the point is that, I mean, there are people who have been poor for centuries and will remain poor unless there is radical change. So you can see why they might embrace it. So there are ruling families, influential families. I spoke to a woman the other day. She's the 15th generation descendant of a Sufi saint. To this day, that family are major landowners in the parliament, you know, ministers, ambassadors, all that. And you know, from the respect they get in their local community and with all their landholdings. Now, it is a very traditional, stultifying setup. If you're not in that family in that area, you're stuffed. Yeah. So that's what they're up against, the people of Pakistan. They face this incredibly unmoving, unchanging situation where a small number of families produce all the politicians and leaders from one generation to the next.
Well, is that one of the problems that the government might face in that we read reports just, I think, last week that the Pakistani government is considering for the first time a very serious attack on militants in the region of North Waziristan. But will they be then seen as being the elite attacking the disaffected?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. In that, you know, the army is a sort of another element in all of this. And frankly, the only, you know, I mean, they would argue, certainly anyway, the only institution holding the whole show together. So certainly the police, more importantly, perhaps, are seen as agents of the landholders. So, you know, you'll find a situation, actually happened in Swat Valley this week, and, you know, the Taliban have been kicked out of there. But it's very striking. All the homes that have been destroyed were those of the leading landowners, and they had been destroyed throughout the valley. You see, another interesting thing is this. The Taliban came in saying, look, we'll take this land, we'll kill the landowners, and we will redistribute the land. But they never did, because they're not only violent, they're venal. So, in fact, the Taliban very rapidly discredit themselves because of their performance once they got power is absolutely hopeless. So you're left with people who had invested hope in them, hopes dashed, And now, in fact, going back to the government, even in its incompetence, better than the Taliban, who are not only incompetent, but also brutal.
Hmm. So, Owen Benton-Jones, where do you see Pakistan's future?
The problems are now so grave. Yeah, you've got a civil war in the northwest. You've got people who can't feed their families. You've got a much wider section of the population who are unable to work now because there are so many power cuts. The power is sort of off almost half the day in some places, and it means all the factories can't work, and that means that all the guys who do day labour, which is most people, aren't getting their $2 or $3 a day.
Let's just elaborate on that, because it's amazing. 30% of all energy produced in Pakistan is stolen by the rich and the poor.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's been going on for years. I mean, yeah. You know, you just sort of tap into the line. But the point is that, yeah, there isn't enough of it. For quite an interesting reason, which is a sort of consumer boom under Musharraf, and everyone bought ACs. It's not only population growth, it was also, in fact, a bit of sort of increasing wealth under those Musharraf years. So they're now very, very short of electricity. And so it means these day labourers, you know, they just can't manage. And they're not getting the cash in. Now, all this, these leading families are sitting there thinking, how on earth are we going to cope? And I think they're getting rattled. I think for the first time here, I haven't been for a few months, and I just detect for the first time a loss of confidence amongst the ruling elite, these upper-class people, that that they're going to be able to do. You know, they've got the answers. I think they're beginning to think they don't have the answers. No, they may well be right, and so that, you know, that lack of self-confidence, I don't quite know where it leads, but it is a sort of new little aspect of Pakistani political development.
It sounds like that leaders will have to emerge who realize that one of the things that has to happen is that they have to be able to have avenues for success for people who haven't been able to grasp it before.
Well, that's the American way, but it's not the Pakistani way.
Fascinating. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Islamabad, Pakistan. Just want to ask you one quick thing. The most heartening thing in light of this failed car bomb attack in Times Square, the most heartening thing you've said is that the Taliban is perhaps incompetent. But do you see that changing if, in fact, they hook up with, let's say, Al-Qaeda insurgents who know more about how to make a car bomb?
Well, what is Al-Qaeda now? You know, its capability has been, you know, very vastly eroded. However, when these failures happen, they learn lessons, adapt, and improve. And so, yes, I think we should all expect that the longer this goes on, the more effective these attacks will become.
Owen, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's take a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have the latest from the Gulf as that giant container box is positioned to cap the leak. Also, as we await a new Supreme Court nominee any day now, what are the constitutional issues that divide the court? That's tomorrow. The very latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Charles River Apparel, over a quarter century of creating apparel for corporations and athletic teams based in New England and family-owned, on Facebook at facebook.com/Charles River Apparel. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Yankee Stadium was the house that Ruth built. In Baltimore, the St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys was the house that built Ruth. From 1902 to 1914, George Herman Babe Ruth attended St. Mary's, part orphanage, part trade school, part reform school. And while there, Ruth learned a trade, tailoring, and from a certain brother Matthias, baseball. In 1950, St. Mary's gave way to the all-boys Cardinal Gibbons School, but Yankee and Red Sox fans regularly visit. And now, citing falling enrollment and rising costs, the Archdiocese of Baltimore says it will close the school in June. That's devastated Cardinal Gibbons faculty, students, and graduates like Wayne McDowell, class of 67. He serves on the school's board of directors. Wayne, what were your thoughts when you heard it was going to close?
I could have just fallen over when I heard it. I mean, you could have knocked me with a feather. Being on the board for the last 10 years, we balanced the budget. Our enrollment was picking up. We thought we were doing everything in line with what the Archdiocese had wanted us to do.
But on the other hand, this is the Catholic Church, and many of the dioceses have had financial problems. They say that's why they have to do this.
Well, I totally agree. As everybody in business this last couple of years, the economy has hurt many. But we have offered, with a group of alumni and investors, to let us become an independent school. Why not sell it to us?
Well, and by the way, you have until Friday to do that. That's the deadline before students have to transfer to other schools to continue their education. You've said that there may be a white knight coming in with the funds. Is that happening?
Well, we got a call today from a doctor in Dallas who sent us $10,000 in. We've had alumni step up, but it's hard to put together a business plan of $6, $7 million in a couple weeks. So if the Archdiocese would have let us know 6 months ago, we could have made a viable and sustainable plan to make it work.
Well, but now you're really under the gun. And I just wonder, just remind us why Babe Ruth's days at what was then St. Mary's were so important. We know he got into a lot of trouble. I mean, he was the son of working parents, and so he was sent to be saved. And wow, was he? I mean, just tell us a little bit about what the school meant to him.
Well, it meant enough to him that when they had the big fire there in 1919, he took the school band around to different ballparks where he played to try to raise money to rebuild the buildings. But during his days at Gibbons, he was one of the best tailors there. And he said if he wouldn't have played ball, he probably could have made 20, 25 hours a day making shirts for people.
Right, he was that good. And what did it mean to you, and then even subsequent, you know, kids who are there today, what does it mean that he went there?
Well, we have one of the smaller Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Baltimore. But our ball teams compete with the big boys in the area, Calvert Hall and Mount St. Joe. Last year went into the finals because boys come there to play baseball there. They're on the same field that Babe Ruth played baseball on.
Yeah. Well, and it is the same field, a little spruced up, but it isn't really the same school that he studied in. That's what the Archdiocese says. Do they have a point?
No, well, no. Two of the buildings are the original buildings, the Fine Arts Building, as we call it. And the print shops were there and the tailor shops. Mm-hmm. And that's the exact building you'll see if you see the pictures of the olden days when Babe Ruth playing ball and hitting the ball from home plate out towards center field. The building behind him is the Fine Arts Building.
Well, and we just wanted to note as well, it seemed like quite a school. It also produced a kid named Al Jolson who had tuberculosis, and so the brothers told him to take long walks and sing.
He was back there in those days also. Yeah, he was quite, I think he was probably the second most renowned person from the school.
Now, Wayne, we know you graduated from the school. Did you play on the field?
Yes, I did. When I was a kid, I was the captain of the baseball team in 1967. And, yeah, it was always a feeling of, wow, I was playing in the same place where the Babe played, although I never hit the ball anywhere near what he did, but it was always a treat to be there.
Wayne McDowell, a graduate of Cardinal Gibbons School, where Babe Ruth learned to play baseball. He's trying to prevent the school's schedule closing in June. Wayne, thanks and good luck to you.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate the opportunity.
And by the way, Wayne also told us that he's been wearing a sign on the back of his jacket that says, Save Cardinal Gibbons. He had considered also adding the words, Fire the Archbishop. But that reminded us of another subversive fashion statement in the world of sports. Today, Cinco de Mayo, the jerseys of NBA's Phoenix Suns will read Los Suns. Its owner, Robert Sarver's response to Arizona's new immigration law. He says, the goal is to honor our Latino community and the diversity of our league, the state of Arizona, and the nation. So tonight, Los Suns meet the San Antonio Spurs. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. A new poll of American Catholics offers a mixed picture of the church. According to the New York Times CBS News survey, a majority of Catholics are critical of Pope Benedict for the way he and the Vatican have handled the clergy sex abuse scandal, but they have confidence in the Vatican to make changes to prevent further abuse. Other findings feel like political polling. You know, people don't like Congress, but they like the person representing them. Well, Catholics feel estranged from the Vatican, but they like their parish priest. In fact, they trust their children to their priest, even though they feel there is still abuse in the U.S. We want to spend a few minutes on the state of the Catholic Church with someone who knows it well, John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and senior Vatican analyst for CNN. He's in Boston today to speak at Boston College in our studio, so John, nice to meet you face-to-face.
It's a great pleasure to be here in person.
You've seen this poll. Any surprises?
Well, you know, in the abstract, I mean, if you knew nothing about what had happened over the last 2 months and you heard that 63% of Catholics who go to Mass at least once a week in America have a favorable impression of the Pope, you would probably think, eh, not bad. Knowing what you know about the relentless drumbeat of criticism of Pope Benedict's handling of the sex abuse crisis over the last 2 months, the fact that two-thirds of Catholics in America still give the guy high marks, I think, is nothing short of a minor miracle.
So you're a glass half full on this, even though many people would say, we thought Catholics always loved their Pope, so 63 might seem low. But what we found interesting is that the poll says only 1 in 10 U.S. Catholics say the scandal has them considering whether or not to leave the church. Now, in 2002, when the scandal was breaking here, it was 1 in 5.
Yeah, although nobody did. I mean, you know, there were apocalyptic predictions back in 02 that there would be dramatic declines in mass attendance and financial contributions to the church and all of that. And it really didn't happen. And I think what this poll confirms is the basic common sense of the Catholic people, which is their faith is in God. Their faith is in the supernatural dimension of the church. They know that the human beings who lead it in any given moment can sometimes fail, and they can occasionally fail spectacularly.
Well, it also seems to show that the closer it is to home, the more you might say you're leaving. For instance, in Germany, 1 in 4 Catholics today say they will leave the church.
Yeah, but people have been leaving the Catholic Church in Germany and across Western Europe for the last 3 decades. I mean, it may have been accelerated by the sex abuse
crisis.
More
than in the U.S.?
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you look at places like France, Germany, Belgium, I mean, you've got mass attendance rates there that get down to 4 or 5%. You know, in the United States, it is still a statistical fact that 25% of Catholics in this country go to Mass at least once a week, which may seem low, but in comparison to Western Europe, it's remarkable.
Let's look at some of the trends you've found in the American church. And there's some good news for the Vatican there. For instance, there's a swath of younger Catholics, 20 to 30-somethings. Many are more secular, but there's a core of the faithful who are increasingly evangelical, and part of that is that they have a positive view of the papacy.
Yeah, I mean, by that core, we're talking about those younger Catholics who are actively practicing their faith. I mean, what you've got is this kind of strong evangelical ethos, which is distinguished by a fondness for traditional devotions, things like Eucharistic adoration and the Virgin Mary, priests wearing Roman collars, sisters wearing the habits, and loyalty to the Pope and to the bishops. Right. And that increasingly is the kind of style that the leaders of the Catholic Church in America of tomorrow are going to bring.
Well, but it's also part of a trend of these sort of strands of the church. Others are, you say the church is increasingly blue-collar, increasingly ethnic. And so this could go either way. These groups like the evangelicals could become more isolated or could blend within the church. Speak about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the drama of the Catholic tomorrow in America. I mean, you're going to have a leadership class that is increasingly focused on traditional Catholic identity. You're going to have grassroots that is increasingly diverse. I mean, if you look at the recent Pew Forum study of religion in America, by 2030, for the first time, whites will no longer be a statistical majority of the American church. They'll be 48%, Hispanics 41%, Asian Americans 8%, Africans and African Americans 3%. Blue-collar, ethnic, low-income, struggling with all the kinds of social problems that blue-collar ethnics in this country face. And so the question is, will this new leadership class move into a ghetto? You know, that's one option, disengage not only from the wider society but from what's going on in the church. Or will the collision with this changing reality on the ground broaden them and open up whole new vistas in terms of where they want to take the church's engagement?
It's tribalized, not polarized. That's another way you have of putting it. People tend to think of the conservative church, the more liberal Catholic church. But you say, no, it's more tribalized.
I mean, there certainly are conservative and liberal Catholics out there,
right.
But those aren't the only slices of life. I mean, you've also got pro-life Catholics, peace and justice Catholics, liturgical traditionalist Catholics, church reform Catholics. And look, I mean, there are almost 70 million Catholics in America. Diversity is inevitable, and in principle, it's a healthy thing. But when it becomes destructive is when these tribes start seeing one another as the enemy. And quite often on the ground, that is the Catholic situation in America.
Another trend you look at is the massive growth of Catholicism in Africa, Latin America, Asia. Two-thirds of the world's Catholics now live in the Southern Hemisphere. And part of that is another trend of Catholic leaders increasingly coming from abroad. Why is it that the ranks of the priests come from either abroad or lay persons? Why aren't there more people wanting to be priests in the Catholic Church?
Well, I mean, there have been slight upticks in seminary enrollment in the United States for the last few years, but it's obviously nowhere near meeting demand. Although the other thing we should say is that even though it is true that seminaries in places like sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia are bursting at the seams, and that's why so many of them are coming overseas, actually, the priest shortage is much worse in those places than it is in Europe and the United States. In Europe and the States, there's a ratio of priests to Catholics of about 1 to 1,300. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's 1 to 6,000. In Southeast Asia, it's 1 to 9,000. And so the long-term future is that priests from abroad are not going to be the solution to the priest shortage in the United States. But in the short term, they're coming here simply because there isn't the infrastructure to support them in the global south. And, you know, in some ways, that's a great thing. I mean, look, those 70 million Catholics in America represent just 6% of the global Catholic population of 1.2 billion. In other words, 94% of the Catholics in the world aren't Americans. And it's a good education for Americans to wake up to that and to realize it's a much more complicated global church out there.
Let's see. Shortage of priests, scandal in the church that some people say had women been more involved in the church may not have happened to the extent that it did. Any chance that women might be allowed into the priesthood?
Short answer, no. But I think there is a lot of room for trying to empower women in all the ways that don't require wearing a Roman collar, things like women serving as chancellors of dioceses, women holding leadership positions in the church, such as being the official spokesperson for the Vatican or for the U.S. Bishops Conference. I mean, all those kinds of administrative roles that don't depend on any kind of special ordination to perform, but historically have largely been performed by men because the church has always been a boys' club. I think that's where the real reform and the real work will be done.
John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and also senior Vatican analyst for CNN in Boston. He'll be speaking at Boston College tonight. We'll have more for our local listeners at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks as always.
It's a great pleasure.
And by the way, for an extended conversation with John Allen, go to our website to hear, for instance, his thoughts on the Catholic Church's lack of communication skills. but well at hereandnow.org. We'd also love to hear from you. You can click on Contact Us to send an email or scroll down and leave a comment right there. Before we go today, a trek up a mountain in Tibet, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. That the Tibetan culture is threatened by Chinese control of Tibet is well known, but less known, the story of the endangered Tibetan Buddhist community outside of Tibet, in Zanskar, in northwest India. Thousands of years old, isolated by a ring of Himalayan mountains, insulated after the Indian government considered it so distant and hard to govern, they closed it off. Zanskar became unable to educate its own children. The nearest school that would teach them their own culture is over a 17,500-foot mountain pass. Well, in a new documentary from filmmaker Frederick Marks, 17 children from Zanskar brave both that pass and deep snow for a chance at an education. They're led by Buddhist monks, for whom this mission is a sacred request from the Dalai Lama. As one of them says, it's an extension of the Bodhisattva vows he took when he became a monk.
When I took Bodhisattva vows, I promise to release all human beings from suffering. That's why I have to do all my power to release at least some people from the suffering.
A scene from the new film Journey from Zanskar. Joining us in the studio is filmmaker Frederick Marks. Welcome.
Thank you.
Help us more to understand this area. Zanskar was once part of Tibet?
Exactly. Historically, for thousands of years, it was considered part of Tibet, but their fate was sealed in 1947 when the British left India and drew the borders of India for the first time. And suddenly, they found themselves as part of this country, India.
It's very difficult to watch your film's beginning. These children, who the monks want to go on this trek, are so young. They're as young as 4 years old?
Yes.
Some of them have already decided they want to become monks, but they may not see their families for 5, 10 years.
More, even. More. And it's already been 5.5, 6 years since we shot the footage, and none of them have been back.
So they anticipate this when we see them first embark on this journey. It's very painful. Why do these parents let their children go?
It's a matter of a couple different factors. I mean, one is there's this amazing opportunity in the outside world that these children will not be exposed to in Zanskar. And then a second lesser factor, but nonetheless significant, is they recognize that their culture is dying. And so it's absolutely essential from their point of view to educate their children from that early age in the Tibetan history, language, and culture.
And the school that they're going to will do just that. Well, then we see them set off, and it's jaw-dropping, because here they are headed out to a 17,500-foot pass, the Himalayas, and they have like a hat, maybe.
The kids don't have gloves. They don't have super heavy coats. They don't have good boots. The one advantage that they may have is the fact that they live at 12,000 feet, and they're used to these horrible winters.
Well, and then the snow gets so deep, even the yaks can't break a trail. Some of the younger children are falling off the horses that have been brought to bring them. Is there any point, Frederick, you've made other documentaries. Hoop Dreams comes to mind. You were one of the three filmmakers on that wonderful film. So you've done this before. But was there ever a point when you said, oh, hold on, people, I can't watch this with these little kids?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's an open question that my film asks is it the right thing to do to send these kids off like this? And my bottom line was, if the mothers and the grandmothers and the fathers and the families feel that it is, then I'm okay with that. The monks themselves, after the fact, recognize that, you know, they have to put that many more efforts into building a school in Zanskar that is universally affordable, that will teach these Tibetan traditions, so that kids no longer have to leave Zanskar in order to get this.
But that's still way in the future. Meantime, here they are trying to get over this pass. They're, 300 feet from the pass in this, picture this vast swath of snow high up in the Himalayas. They just can't do it.
couldn't get over it. The yaks refused to go forward. They were plowing the trail ahead. The horses were slipping off the trail. They were throwing children. They were throwing bags. So we couldn't do it.
At this point, in watching the film, there's a big, oh, no. But there's a calmness to their turning around. Was there something about their Buddhism that helped them?
Well, absolutely. There's no question. There's a deep equanimity, really, that, you know, challenges and frustrations that for me would be, you know, okay, that's it, I give up. For them are like, okay, well, that's not working. What can work? Yeah. And they just move right on to the next thing.
Which was Plan B, which was also heart-stopping. This is a combination of bus and some land vehicles that they took, hairpin turns, through dangerous areas, because, you know, the question would be, wait a second, if there are buses, a combination of buses that they could put together, why didn't they do that in the first place? Why didn't they?
Yeah, well, there are a couple reasons. One is the expense. And by that time, even the roads were officially closed.
Yeah.
So if you travel over these mountain roads in India, you do so at your own risk. If you go off the road with a bus full of kids, the Indian government's like, well, good luck.
Well, finally, after this hair-raising bus trip, the kids do make it, and we see a little bit of them starting their new lives, including meeting the Dalai Lama. And as you pointed out, there have been some changes since you first filmed. First of all, monks are looking to build a school in Zanskar. But also, there's some irony in that a road is being built that will connect Zanskar to the outside world, and so, yay, they won't have to walk over that pass or take that terrible hairpin bus ride. But, oh, they may not be as isolated, but will their culture now be obliterated because they have access to the outside world?
Well, exactly. The monks recognize that dichotomy, and they're doing what they can to play both sides of the game. I mean, yes, the positives are hospitals, medicine, regular food supply, and, yes, it could mean the very end of the thing that they're trying to save. So at the same time that they're trying to build a school, they're also putting in a museum, and they're putting in a guest house to welcome visitors to hopefully get them invested in supporting the preservation of the culture.
Yeah. What chances do you think they have?
I think it's slim, frankly. And yet, there's no other choice but to do what you can.
That's filmmaker Frederick Marks. His documentary is Journey from Zanskar, about this isolated Tibetan Buddhist village in northern India. For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And by the way, Frederick Marks, as we said, you were one of the filmmakers behind Hoop Dreams, which is about two inner-city Chicago teens who go to an Illinois private school to play basketball. It seems like a leap from that to a film about Buddhism in Zanskar.
It was Pico Iyer who sort of pointed out to me the similarities between this film and Hoop Dreams, which I myself wasn't even aware of. I mean, it's really about families sending off their children to give them a leg up and a chance for a better life. And that happens exactly in Hoop Dreams. Both William Gates and Arthur Agee, I mean, their families send them out to this largely white suburban high school. This is the difference. You know, William Gates and Arthur Agee at some level had to sacrifice an experience of immersion in African-American urban culture in order to get this leg up at this largely white suburban high school. With these kids, the point of sending them away is actually to retain the culture.
But still, true. I hadn't thought of that either. Both films are about parents thinking they're doing what's best for their kids by sending them away.
Yeah. And for education.
Yeah. Frederick Marks, thanks so much.
Thank you.